You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2013 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. You know, it's hard to imagine, isn't it, that in the 19th century, our homes were lit by burning whale oil, the oil of leviathan creatures who were harpooned to death by hand far at sea, as chronicled in Melville's Moby Dick. Graham Burnett's book, The Sounding of the Whale, Science and Cetaceans in the 20th Century, begins in the 1860s when the Norwegian invention of the grenade harpoon fired from a cannon plus steam power ushered in a new era of whaling. Burnett's book, which is on the scale of a great 19th century novel, takes in the work of zoologists, paleontologists, biological oceanographers, ecologists, neurologists, and mathematicians, among others. He tells the sweeping story of whales as problems of knowledge since 1900. He weaves Melvillian madness with industrial killing, New Age environmentalism with Cold War Minecraft. The Sounding of the Whale covers a period that saw whales go from industrial commodities to avatars of the Age of Aquarius. It's a magnificent effort to come to terms with what may be the human being's most troubled relationship with another animal. Graham Burnett is a professor of history and history of science at Princeton and as well a true polymath. He studies the relationship between power and knowledge and writes on human beings' changing understanding of nature, art, and technology. In addition to The Sounding of the Whale, which he'll discuss with Amy Parrish tonight, he is the author of four other books, including Trying Leviathan, the 19th century New York court case that put whales on trial and challenged the order of nature, and that won the New York City Book Award in 2008. And he's currently a Guggenheim Fellow. We're very happy to have him here tonight, direct from New York. Dr. Amy Parrish, we're always delighted to invite Amy back to Aloud. She is a biological anthropologist, a primatologist, and Darwinian feminist. She's conducted groundbreaking research on patterns of female dominance and matriarchal social structure in one of our closest living relatives, the bonobo. She's actually currently making a TV series with and for bonobos. Formerly a professor at USC, she is now affiliated faculty at Georgetown and a research associate at University College London, and she is also someone who has given years of deep thought to the relationship between humans and animals and scientists and society. Please welcome Graham Burnett and Amy Parrish to the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for being here tonight for our discussion of The Sounding of the Whale. I'm excited to be in dialogue with Graham Burnett. I'm fascinated by the depth and breadth of his skills and interests, which are on clear display in this 800-page book, which I also use for bicep curls while I'm walking around reading it. And I think there are so many approaches that we could take to this, and there will be a chance at the end for all of you to participate, and we're really interested in your perspectives and what you have to share as well. Instead of kind of a chronological history of the 20th century, I thought maybe it would be interesting to talk about some of the key players and what roles they played in the evolution of whale science in the 20th century, and then kind of elaborate from there. And the names that really stand out to me start with Harmer in England. I don't know if that seems like a good jumping off place for you or...
Sure,
yeah.
Sure.
Could you tell us a little bit about him?
Yeah, so what I should probably do to set up an answer to that question is give you some little bit of a feel for what the book tries to do. My disciplinary home at Princeton is in history of science. So historians of science are historians who have a kind of insatiable curiosity about the dynamics of technology and human beings' changing understanding of nature and physical laws over the last couple hundred years. So science, whales, you know, why exactly? Well, it should be said, since this is a Moby Dick week here in LA, that the big, strange middle of that book, many of you will remember and know, is a kind of bizarre excursus into the scientific study of these animals, right? Cetology. In fact, there's even a kind of evolutionary account put together by literary historians of how the book was made that says it started out as just a funny little sea tale of, you know, a fictionalized version of the sinking of the Essex, and that as such it was just going to be a kind of short yarn. And then into the middle of it, Melville began to lard these technical passages about the internal anatomy and the physiology and the behavior, the taxonomy, the systematics. And as he did so, he began to see the nearly infinite sort of tropical potentiality of those technical scientific elements, meaning that all of that could be metaphorical, even as it was literal. And that, you know what larding is, right? Like larding, you take that nice roast that could be a little dry, and you stick those little lines of fat through it or encase it. So there's a situation where the text of that story was enriched and made juicy and thick by means of the judicious and then finally possibly histrionic, even hysterical, addition of scientific stuff. And the truth is, my interest in this material was born in Moby Dick. Mm-hmm. It was reading Moby Dick as a person very interested in science that turned me to the question of what the sciences have made of these kind of most mysterious organisms.
Well, and it's so encyclopedic too. It's wonderful the way you trace the whole trajectory, and I had no idea how fascinating it would actually be, and kind of disturbing. And I think for a Southern California audience in the 21st century, where we've come to really love whales and venerate them and not only see them as something for human use, it almost seems really foreign and it's a little aversive to read about how we used to see whales, really until the 80s. It's just quite a turn in the last.
It's absolutely true, and you know, I want to come back and get this kind of question of a couple of the heroes of the story, because there are some cetologists, to use that Melvillian term, some whale scientists. Scientists who study whales don't really use that term much anymore. They prefer marine mammal biologists now, but you'll still find a few old world characters who will throw cetologist around, the scientist of the cetaceans. I want to come back and get some of those hero figures, but you put your finger on what ends up being an essential arc in the story, because we now think of whales and dolphins, I think I can say that for us, there's a pretty largely shared feeling that these are special organisms, that they are probably kind of pretty intelligent, that they have some communicative capabilities. The story of how those animals have come to function for us, sort of post-1974, let's say, as charismatic megafauna, as
sentient
bellwethers of human environmentally responsibility, totems of the counterculture. I mean, that image of the whale, not widely shared circa, pick a date. 1860? No. And that's our Melville moment. But Melville couldn't have even dreamed of what the modern whaling industry would be, right? I mean, you think whaling, you think rowboat, cold steel, ships under sail, the oil being used for what? Lamps, which is sort of quaint, fetching. And then, you know, the baleen being used for corset stays and all that great kind of New England-y stuff. But, like, when there are somewhere around 3 million large cetaceans taken out of the world's oceans between, say, 1902 and 1970, what were people doing with them? Does anybody know? It's kind of just one of those, like, great questions. When you have scenes like this,
yeah,
this is the jawbone of a blue whale. Let's see if I can make this thing work. Yeah, jawbone of a blue whale on the deck of one of these creatures, which I suspect many of you will have seen, although this is a particularly early instance of a factory vessel. So this is a stern slipway factory vessel, meaning a full processing plant that could roam freely in the open ocean, attended by a set of catcher vessels, themselves steam-driven, diesel-powered later in the century. The catcher vessels would shoot the animals with these grenade harpoons, which would explode into the animal, killing it. This is what we still see in the modern industry. It's still prosecuted by Japan and a couple of other countries. Mm-hmm. What was being done with all those millions of animals? Does anybody know? It's such a... so weird. It's gonna blow your minds. It really is. I heard perfume, and it is true that you some whale products end up in perfumey things. Although that you don't build, and this is not to be kind of dismissive of the answer. It's a perfectly legitimate answer. I often get it, but you don't build sort of companies at the scale of Leverhulme or Unilever on, you know, perfume. Soap, somebody who's familiar with Lever soap knows that soap is pretty important, and soap is a major component of the industry, although interestingly not in dollar value, the primary, amazingly enough. Now, things get more creative, both true. Nitroglycerin, so glycerin, which is a byproduct of saponification, soap making out of fats, is one of the things that gets made. And before the development of smokeless powder in the Second World War, there is a little funny moment around World War I where what is usually a byproduct of saponification, glycerin, actually became the primary product. People needed it for explosives. But we still haven't touched on the big dollar item across all those years. And I don't want to use up all our time on it. Mm-hmm. Mineral oil, lubricants, actually. The jaw oil of small odontocetes was a very important fine lubricant. And there's a derivative of a derivative product present in the wax of sperm whales. It's a wax, not an oil, that is very important in transmissions and transmission fluid. But these are still... Say again?
Sewing machines.
And sewing machines, yeah. Again. Okay, yeah. So we'll just drop this bomb on you. Margarine. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's human consumption. It's the majority of the fat that is derived from the blanket layer of the large baleen whales. The primary purpose to which that oil was placed was... in butter substitutes in continental Europe between 1916 and 1965. So once you can hydrogenate a liquid fat and get it to be solid at room temperature, that was developed by the Germans using nickel catalysts in the interwar period, you end up with... here's one of those funny moments. It not so much in the United States, interestingly, not because of our conservation inclinations in the period, but because of the extraordinary power of the dairy lobby. Somebody here knew. Yeah, the dairy lobby was seriously down on margarines of all kinds, and they helped ensure the passage of a set of weird laws, like, for instance, that you couldn't put the colorants into margarine that made it look like butter, so that some people, there's probably no one in the audience who would remember this, but back in the very old days, you would buy margarine and it would actually be like a little thing of kind of looking like Vaseline a little bit, and then you could get a little thing of, there was like a colorant pill, and you couldn't buy them pre-mixed, and that was because the dairy lobby wanted you to look at that Vaseline and think about it as you put the color pill in, and then it would look like butter at the end. So, okay, and then I just, so we don't lose ourselves in incredibly disgusting stuff like this, because it's a very long book, and this is a very, we're talking about three sentences in the book right here. The other things that happened were that after you'd stripped the blubber off of the animal, the meat was dried and granulated and used as a protein supplement in the early development of intensive agriculture, you know, intensive animal processing. Husbandry is barely what it kind of is. Factory food production using live creatures. So chickens, very importantly, but also cattle protein supplements. It isn't easy to get those animals to eat meat. But if you work hard enough at it, you can slip it in with the other stuff, and they grow faster if you do that. And then what was the most disgusting stuff that's left over when you're finished taking that stuff was used as fertilizer. So there's a very interesting story about kind of the meat economy that was crucial across the sort of big belly of the 20th century as intensive agriculture and intensive fur farming and meat production create demands, now interestingly being fed much more by a different set of ocean products, small fish, you know. Mm-hmm. You buy, everybody talks about eating salmon, you know, it's like kind of, but then in fact the salmon's all being fed stuff that's being, uh-huh, you know, radically, unsustainably dredged up in other places. So we still, you know, need lots and lots and lots and lots of protein and lots and lots and lots and lots of fat, and we keep finding it in nature, but you got to fish down the food chain, and this was large, top of the food chain type stuff that made it easy to catch.
So we're talking about kind of the situation of whales in industry, and of course Melville was sort of the whale of legend, and then in the middle of all that is this the whale of science, you know, and it's not divorced certainly from either legend or industry. In fact, it's very complicit in industry, and I think it's actually fascinating because it's not the first or the last time that this has happened in science, and I want to come back to that, kind of what are the modern day equivalents, but I do think it's part of the disturbing part of the book is how much science was tied to imperial interests and to industry interests throughout. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I mean, people I think will have felt by this point that the arc of the book is to try to explain how these animals go from being thought of as soulless, monstrous kegs of fat to becoming these soulful, musical friends of humanity. Okay, so that's the cultural arc. But it isn't just a cultural history. What I want to understand is what was the role of science in affecting, transforming, creating the conditions of possibility for that rethinking? And in what ways did that rethinking, in turn, change the kinds of science that could be done? So that's the kind of reciprocating story that I try to tell in the book. The allusion here is to the remarkable entanglement of the scientific study of these animals with the industry. Because if you wanted to study whales, you had a couple of options for most of the 20th century. You could go to a beach and wait for between 5 and 15 years for one to wash ashore, or you could go find a whaler and ask him if you could go along on his whaling vessel. And so a big chunk of my story is the story of scientists like these. This is Sidney Harmer, who was the keeper of zoology at the Natural History Museum, the British Museum in London. One of the early scientists to say, my God, we are tapping out these creatures at a rate that can't be sustainable. Mm-hmm. And coming out of the kind of traditions of the British Raj and kind of game protection in Africa, he had a pretty, to my mind, ahead of his time, although mm-hmm. historians professionally find that term distasteful because everybody's kind of in their time. But nevertheless, a forethinking, shall we say, attitude toward these animals, and who began to see to it that major scientific expeditions were undertaken in conjunction with or adjacent to the industry in different ways in order to try to get a statistical grasp and a kind of basic biological grasp of the organisms. And then someone like this, to whom allusion has been made, Neil Allison McIntosh, who was the guy who kind of headed up the research initiative, really the global scientific research initiative into the animals. These are not people you would have heard. But this poor guy got just completely kind of captured by the industry in many respects. That was the only way he could get the research done that he wanted to be doing. And in the course of bringing hundreds of scientists into an encounter with these animals in the context of whaling ships, he basically produced a kind of multiple generations of whale scientists acculturated to the industry. I mean, they spent their lives in situations, you know, more or less like this. Show a couple of those whale scientists on the Flensing platform. Ugly work. This is at Grytviken, South Georgia, the Antarctic convergence. Some blasted whales also at Grytviken. This is the kind of statistical work that was being done. But here's a guy actually, you know, doing scientific work. Well, he looks exactly like a whaleman, doesn't he? Mm-hmm. And they also did marking of the animals so that they could figure out their migration patterns and collect information about life cycle. But how did this work? Well, somebody had to shoot the whale in order to collect the mark, right? That's how the marks were recovered. Somebody chopped up the whale and put it through the boilers, and when they finished boiling out the animal in one of those factory ships, they found this little tube dart of a mark at the bottom of the grox, the hideous stuff at the bottom. And that was how they were able to make the migration charts and able to build life cycle diagrams like this. But needless to say, if then you were suddenly saying, you know, I think we need to use science to get control of this industry, you had a bunch of scientists who were very awkwardly positioned with respect to that because all their best friends were whalemen, and they suddenly got very nervous that they'd never have any material.
And it's not like it's only in the science of studying whales. I mean, this is sort of the tradition of natural history. You go to our natural history museum, it's full of stuff that was killed by scientists and brought back to collect. And I mean, that was sort of, I think of Ernst Mayr, and I think one of the things that it mentioned in his obituary was that he held the record for having consumed the most birds of paradise of anyone on the planet. So he was in New Guinea watching them, and every night he put one in the cooking pot. And I mean, that's, you know, not how we would like to see science done today. But this is even different than that, because Ernst Mayr wasn't depending on an industry to get him into New Guinea, and they weren't dependent on him saying, oh, you know, what you're doing is sustainable. And so this was a much more awkward kind of marriage.
It's a great point. I mean, the naturalist tradition of being in the field with your, you know, gun and your camera was in some ways a tradition of great importance. I mean, obviously, you know, Charles Darwin was a crack wing shooter long before he got interested in evolution, right? I mean, in fact, if anything, the idea of doing a round the world trip when he was kind of miserably stuck in medical school in Edinburgh dissecting stinking corpses, part of the appeal was, gosh, I'd love to be in the pampas, you know, doing some upland game shooting. And the way to do that was to put yourself forward as a collector. But that tradition of the naturalist collector wrong-footed this generation of gentlemen of whom I'm speaking, because many of them did have those characters of the late 19th century in their minds as they set out for year-long voyages, but they were coming to be entangled in a machine at a totally different scale. I mean, this is industrial slaughter at a scale genuinely inconceivable to the 19th century naturalists.
Yeah, and I think, you know, Harmer, I think, did a very good job of sounding the alarm early about the disastrous consequences of overconsumption and lack of control. McIntosh, it seems, really bought more into the idea that, I mean, I don't think his approach was ever, maybe we should stop. It was just more about, well, you know, how can we get the stats, which are never good enough to actually make a difference or to draw a line, to come to a bottom line?
Yeah, so that actually pulls us, you know, into the 1950s in a sense, and McIntosh is working in a different context, a different environment than Harmer, who's more a figure of the 20s and 30s. Part of the reason that a book on this subject has kind of larger importance to people who care about the history of environmentalism is, have you heard of the IWC? The International Whaling Commission. You know, every beginning of every summer, you read in the newspaper, IWC delegates are meeting, they're arguing, is Japan going to keep whaling? You know, what's going to happen? That body, the IWC, was a really radical new project when it was founded in the immediate post-World War II period. It was going to be the first genuinely international regulatory body that would set catch quotas and control an industry totally internationally, an industry that's working outside the jurisdiction of any set of national laws, right? The oceans, wide open, no man's land. If you can take it, you can take it home. The IWC was created in that same moment that the UN was being created, and FAO, and UNESCO. It was part of that same post-war moment of kind of global governance. And what made it really special was that its global scope was made to hinge on this crucial covenant, Article 2, that the IWC would set catch quotas in real time entirely based on best scientific recommendations. So this was like the fantastic new world in which scientists would sort of have an industry by the nose, and government would back the scientists.
And America played a role in that, because we didn't have such a tradition of whaling to the same extent as Europe. So they were pretty crucial, weren't they, in the IWC in terms of moving away from such a tight link to industry.
The U.S., and in fact, one of the scientist statesmen on whom I write at some length in the book is a guy named Remington Kellogg, an American naturalist who cared a lot about whales, did a lot of scientific work. And he and the U.S. government helped shape the formation of the IWC and then helped really try to steer those first years where what everyone was trying to do was figure out how you would make scientific recommendations effective in the real political world. Now, this is like still all of our problem. Like, you know, how do you, the scientists say X about fill in the blank. Global warming, carbon emissions, you know, deforestation, salination, water table. But then that recommendation goes into the hurly-burly of competing interests, and, well, it gets watered down or it doesn't get, you know, activated. So many of those dynamics one can watch play out in extremely precise and detailed ways, and in ways that I think prove kind of formative for what ultimately evolves in the debates around whether whaling could be controlled across the 1950s and 1960s. And in part, it's a story about evidence, like what kind of evidence will bring a $100 million industry that's massively overcapitalized to heel, you know?
And yet, to a large extent, even though there's all that science and that that drive to collect evidence, wasn't it Kellogg's political mastery of the situation and his ability to use PR and diplomacy that in the end made more of a difference than the science?
Yeah, so, you know, a part of the meat in the middle of the book is to try to show that it's something of a false dichotomy to argue that you've got science on the one hand and politics on the other, and that you have these sort of naive Pollyannish scientists trying to bring their little facts about nature into the, you know, arena, the gladiatorial combat arena of parliamentary debate, and that they get mashed up and sent home bruised and whimpering. That's a way that the story traditionally gets told, and it lets the scientists kind of be victim, hero, martyrs. What I try to show is that, in fact, the group of scientists who were trying to make all this work were extremely savvy politicians. They were statesmen of different sorts. And indeed, that the work of establishing truths that can hold their own in any agonistic setting is very familiar to scientists. That's the basic work they have to do. It's a critical agonistic enterprise when it's occurring among scientists. So there's a kind of politics internal to the work of establishing facts, just as politics ultimately must root itself in the actual. So without going too deep into it, a chunk of the book tries to show that the scientists in question were ultimately effective in part because they knew how to be smart about politics, even though they also developed, and this is a section of the book for the real diehards, they also developed some very powerful early mathematical models that enabled them to do something other than sort of gesture obliquely at what they thought might be a nice idea, and instead it's really a very important moment in the history of mathematical modeling in general, and of the applicability of mathematical models to kind of collective decision making. So there's a section of the book that deals with that.
And that kind of data, of course, was very important ultimately after it felt like decades with the IWC not being effective in actually calling for a moratorium and getting that passed. And yet within that, you know, Kellogg did such a wonderful job, I thought, when he consulted with Bostelman, the artist. I don't know if you have any of these paintings. Humans are not really that receptive to facts. If you have an opinion, facts to the contrary might just make you dig in even deeper, and there's a lot of data on that. But if you can tell a great story, you can change people's opinion through stories. And so Kellogg, I thought, was quite sophisticated in his recognition of that. And so he consulted with this artist on you know, how to convey what does a whale look like to the public.
Yeah, this was a special issue of National Geographic that was published in 1945 with illustrations by a quite well-known illustrator-painter. And she worked intimately with the lead scientist at the IWC at the time to produce what were a totally groundbreaking set of images of the animals, depicting in particular sort of kind of something like, you know, maternal affection, this kind of gambling and kind of play. This is, again, you've got a little hapless calf sucking at the teat of its tender dam. And an image like this of the animals in peril and threatened by a grenade harpoon. Reading, and a section of the book looks closely at how hard Kellogg and Bostelman worked to like resist the editors of National Geographic, who were like, can you do us a picture of like, you know, like a Moby Dickhead smashing through the side of a boat and the like big teeth of the thing, like, you know, clamping a couple of sailors? And they're like, well, you know, actually, there's good evidence that that happened like almost once in the history of the world, and that by and large, the animals just try really hard to get the hell out of everyone's way. So, you know, it would be kind of more true to the business of the representation of these animals and their life ways if we omitted that picture and instead focused on like their ordinary behaviors and so forth. And so, you know, you get this kind of exchange, which is a kind of PR work in a sense. Mm-hmm. And part of what I dug out, and this is kind of like historian inside baseball, but historians get special kudos for spending lots of time in archives and finding like dusty boxes of stuff that no one has looked at before. And I got like one small like silver star over here for finding one of those kinds of dusty boxes that contained to a person who cares about this kind of stuff. And it may not be all of you, I realize. Like 400 pages of documentation about an organization called the Council for the Conservation of Whales, which was created by a bunch of conservation-oriented scientists in the 1920s here in the United States, way before anybody had previously thought there was anything like that kind of activist movement. And what was amazing about this box of documents is not only that they created such an organization, or that that organization was a kind of who's who list of American progressive kind of wildlife enthusiasm, but in fact that they hired a Madison Avenue PR firm to help them place stories in newspapers about how kind of whales were tender little creatures that were getting the short end of the stick at the, you know, behest of the Norwegians. And literally the scientists were writing each other letters, which I could show you, where they're like, you know, who's going to write this screed? Who's going to dish up another, like, you know, big bowl of saccharin ice cream for those, you know, lazy guys at the newspapers so that we can get people focused on this? And at the time, there was a congressional bill to see if the U.S. would help the League of Nations get involved in the control of the whaling industry. So it was like very kind of modern, what we think of as modern, work to mobilize science to kind of create human interest stories and get people emotionally invested and that kind of stuff.
And we are very particular on what we care about. We care much more about a whale than a dung beetle. And so if you can tap into what we feel sentimental about, and this is a big problem for the paleoanthropologists. When you dig up a fossil, if you can't argue that it's an ancestor of a human, you don't get your next year's funding. And so that's why every year you hear that there's a new human ancestor out there, the latest missing link, right? And so it's not always industry that's controlling kind of the impetus of science. It can just be also from within academia as well.
I mean, the craziest part of that specific story, like people's emotional investment with the animals, in the end really falls later, though, than the 20s and 30s. And it's in some ways the funkiest part of this book is the final section. It deals with the period from the, like, 58 to 72, which sees this crazy confluence of different interests that more or less hand us the whale we know on a silver platter by the early 70s. And what do I mean by crazy confluence of interest? Well, one of them is shown here. A nickel for anybody who has a guess as to what this scientist, actually working right up here at Point Magoo in the early 1960s, what do we think he is doing there, dockside? This is actually a naval bioacoustician working for the Navy who has got a defunct baby Tursiops truncatus with a implanted miniature sound projector, otherwise known as a sonar transducer, which has been hammered into its head. And it's set up on a stereotactic frame such that he can steer it underwater back and forth in order to produce these polar diagrams of the propagation of sound waves through the melon on the front part of the head of Tursiops. Why is the Navy investing huge amounts of money in this research, one wonders? Well, many of you will know that the odontocetes have pretty impressive echolocatory capabilities, and the Navy gets interested in those in the 50s, just as it gets interested in cataloging all of the sound-producing organisms in the sea. So suddenly there are tons and tons of biologists who are getting hired by the Navy, marine biologists in particular, in order to catalog the production of sounds by organisms underwater, many of which are cetaceans. I wonder why. This is an integral component of submarine warfare. So the US and the Soviet Union set up underwater sound stations for listening, SOSUS, and SOFAR stations, sound fixing and ranging stations. And those stations almost immediately began picking up all kinds of crazy noise. And some of that noise could be used to mask military work, and some of it might be military work until people figure out what it is. But it's in fact snapping shrimp, fin whales, sperm whales, and you know what's coming. Who's the big sound producer with whom we began? Humpbacks. So humpbacks, I mean, that humpbacks made noise was sort of not by any means unknown, and yet it became the object of inquiry first to the world's navies as they recorded vast amounts of this stuff and began thinking, how could this stuff be used to mask submarine sounds? How could it be used to transmit signals if we were emulating it that wouldn't be picked up by the other guys, et cetera, et cetera? And into the mix come a set of scientists who start tapping military resources to do work on marine mammals. Should we go to this character?
I know he makes you... Let's talk about Lily. It's very unsavory in some ways, depending on her tastes.
Kind of an amazing person. Again, a person who ends up being a California person. Does anybody know John Cunningham Lilly? That name is recognizable to some people, probably who come from different domains, but some of you may remember him from the heyday of his dolphin work in the 1960s. Others may remember him as a sort of back pages of Omni magazine character in a jumpsuit, hyping the virtues of vitamin K and psychopharmaceuticals. Maybe someone here ran into him at Esalen in 68 or 69. But in the 50s, he was like where it's at as a pioneering biomedical researcher in neurophysiology. He'd studied with Wilder Penfield. He was a section head at the National Institutes of Mental Health outside of Washington, D.C. He spent a lot of his life mapping the cortex of macaques. Mm-hmm. So here we're in your
mm-hmm. Well, Andy was in the CIA, or working with the CIA.
And it is true that if you were a person who could hammer electrodes into the brains of a living creature and monitor how much pain it was experiencing, there were a set of characters who often came in train who had a lot of interest in that sort of thing. Because you're talking about the heyday, 58, 59... of the sort of Manchurian candidate era sciences of mind and behavior. So everything from the early psychopharmaceuticals, which of course, many of which in the period emerged in the context of research into breaking or temporarily disabling enemy agents. I mean, I know this sounds kind of cloak and dagger, but I'm really not making this stuff up, right? LSD is brought into experimental work in the United States in connection with research in veterans hospitals to help people recovering from what we would now think of as post-traumatic stress disorder. So it was as an aid to psychotherapy to help people kind of communicate better. But it was also used by the CIA, who mickeyed each other with it, and there are several longstanding wrongful death suits. There's one in particular, a wrongful death suit that resulted from that work. Lily was in the thick of all that too, pulls the ripcord circa 58 and stops working with macaques, having discovered sun and surf in the Virgin Islands and having decided that cetaceans have bigger and more interesting brains than macaques, successfully pitches a whole bunch of government agencies on the dolphin as a model organism for thinking about a whole bunch of things, including communication, gets money from NASA, quite a lot of money from NASA, because by this point already you have folks thinking about whether or not we'll ever kind of encounter, this is the period where the young Carl Sagan is doing work at SETI, right, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. So NASA's interested in a model organism for thinking about interspecies communication. What would it be like to break through to a non-human intelligence? And Lilly gets enough money to build a dedicated laboratory in the Virgin Islands called the Communications Research Institute, where he conducts research on primarily Tursiops truncatus for the military, for the Navy. By this point, the Navy has a marine mammal program, which ultimately gives rise to what some of you will know, which is that there are marine mammals in the Navy even now. It's sort of being phased out now, but there were marine mammals that were deployed in Vietnam as part of a sapper interdiction program in Cam Ranh Bay. All that's born here. Very strange moment. Lilly writes a couple of popular books that give us this story of these animals' extraordinary intelligence. Roughly contemporaneous with Planet of the Apes. So another kind of like, mm-hmm. the primates are going to suddenly get intelligent and fight back. Well, some of you will know George C. Scott's movie, Day of the Dolphin. There's a similar story that's told about these animals, dolphins and whales, that they're kind of intelligent animals that are going to fight back. When Lilly starts not just dropping acid, because he has an experimental interest in LSD as a result of his brain work, but he's trying to break through to the dolphins, right? He's trying to communicate with them. And what has LSD been used for now for 10 or 15 years, but as a facilitator of communication? You see where this is going. By 63, 64, he's giving LSD to the dolphins and taking it himself in an effort to sort of commensurate himself with them and divest himself of his own limitations, his own cognitive limitations. Tunes in, turns on, drops out, loses his funding, because NSF starts being like, I don't know. But it's kind of a very complicated moment, because there are a lot of people giving LSD to all kinds of animals in 1962, and no one's laughing, right? It's sort of pre-Timothy Leary, LSD isn't what LSD becomes. This is that kind of basic historian's point, right? LSD becomes LSD as we know it across exactly this watershed. Upshot. Out of Lilly, and specifically out of what then becomes a kind of showdown between the growing importance of a kind of military application of these animals and this kind of countercultural vision of Lilly headed off to Esalen in the jumpsuit, you basically, that gives you a kind of a cue as to how it could be that by 72 at Stockholm at the UN Conference on the Environment, dolphins and whales end up like, why are there like hundreds and hundreds of kids marching behind a huge inflatable cetacean in Stockholm?
You've got a great picture of that, too.
We do, yeah, we can pull that back up. The answer is the whales and dolphins, this taxon, had ended up functioning as a kind of crucial kind of fantasy organism in the showdown between the kind of hawks and the doves at the tail end of the Vietnam War. So that by 1976, you get somebody at National Geographic, which recall previously wanted to show, you know, Moby Dick.
The lions of the sea.
Of the sea, like the whales chomping people, is saying, you know, the whales become a way of thinking about our planet and its creatures. So that's how you get to the tail end of that story. And
yeah, that's a really interesting arc, and you know, one of the questions that you raise in the book is, you know, how much of what science is doing actually leads to their conservation, which was Harmer's idea way back in the beginning of the century in Britain, and how much of it comes from actually moving into activism, you know, and I know this was a problem for Jane Goodall, you know, when she was working in Tanzania initially, she did not want to get involved in any kind of the debates about chimps and labs, chimps and circuses, experimenting on chimps, et cetera, because she didn't want to lose her funding, she didn't want to be tied up in all of that, and yet her her real impact on the chimps is, I would argue, is really in the activist that she became. And so I just see in reading your book this, it's sort of like, well, the more things change, the more they stay the same. So, you know, I mean, aren't we doing the same thing now with climate change, where you're seeing the same kind of, you know, inertia, where it seems like there's this narrative that there's two sides to the story, or we don't have all the data, and it's not really like that, if you could step back?
Yeah, I mean, here you, I'm not sure I've ever really thought about it kind of quite this way, but you're really talking about the kind of juncture between, you know, epistemology and cultural agency. So, you know, epistemology, kind of theories of knowledge, and historians of science are interested in how people come to make claims to know things and get people to believe them, right? That's a super interesting problem. What are the technologies by which some people get to speak for what's really real about nature and be believed? But it can't be denied that sort of cultural agents, those who can dramatize, make compelling, seize us, the kinds of artists and charismatic performers, have a kind of cultural agency all their own, and where they are adjacent to or pivoting from what has been claimed about nature, there's a particular kind of thing that happens. And, you know, this might be,
to stay with
the whale story for a moment. I mean, it's the one I know best. Now you can see these kinds of showdowns on kind of cable television, I think, almost any night of the week. But this was a very specific moment, 1975. This is the newly reformed in 1975, Greenpeace, which had previously had no interest in whales, but which had rather been a loose aggregation of Quakers and freaks who had been centrally concerned with protesting French nuclear weapons testing in Polynesia, and who were turned to this kind of Marshall McLuhan-esque mind bomb moment. They were all readers. They were Canadians, right? They're out of Vancouver. They were all readers of McLuhan. And they were turned to this kind of work by a charismatic scientist named Paul Spong, who was a total Lilly clone. He read his John Lilly, and he, too, wanted to kind of have a breakthrough encounter with a captive marine mammal. He worked in the Vancouver Aquarium. He did indeed, in connection with, and I don't believe that I'm susceptible to any kind of libel suit if I say this, in connection with experimentation with psychopharmaceuticals, came to believe that he was kind of in a very special relationship with these animals, and ultimately felt that that needed to be politicized, got together a bunch of his friends in a boat, and headed out in Zodiacs and put themselves between Soviet whalers on the Mendocino Ridge and the sperm whales that they were hunting. And back then, nobody was ready for that kind of thing, and so the hardy Soviet whalers had absolutely no compunctions whatsoever firing a 120-pound explosive grenade harpoon directly over the heads of the kids in the boat. And in about a minute of incredibly wobbly Super 8 footage, these guys caught this incredible David and Goliath encounter, which they then carried back, and when they docked in San Francisco, immediately got it into the hands of CBS News, and Walter Cronkite, you know, that's the way it was, America, showed this footage in 75, and it was a sea change moment for the global environmental movement, the countercultural, youth-driven environmental movement. So here's a kind of tendril affiliation, if you will, of Lilly's work. Lilly, by this point, is kind of off the radar screen in a lot of ways, but no Lilly and no Lilly science, no Spong, no scene like this. And the other great instance of the way kind of cultural productivity can transform life when it sits in relation to the sciences creatively and dynamically is right here, the, again, a kind of epochal article in Science that went on to have tremendous cultural ramifications, including right here tonight, because we began with Songs of the Humpback Whale, and you all kind of, you knew immediately when you came into the room the kind of thing we'd be doing, because that has a certain kind of meaning, because, you know, there are endless thousands of folk songs and symphonic pieces that have been composed in relation to this. And what was it? It was noise for the Navy, circa 1952. But when one of those Navy guys passed a couple of the tapes that had been recorded in a Bermuda SOFAR and SOSIS listening station to a young acolyte of Lilly's who'd worked in his lab parsing sound spectrographs of dolphin phonation to look for word elements, right? He's trying to teach the dolphins words or see what words they might be using. Parsing of these visual representations of sound was what this guy, Scott McVeigh, second author on this paper, had spent some considerable chunk of his life doing at Lilly's knee. And he used those same techniques on that Navy-recorded noise from the sperm whales. And he's like, it's not speech. But he was hanging with an ornithologist at the same time, a guy who worked on birdsong. He's like, it's song. It has the kind of repetitious architecture and larger patterning that we associate with musicality. And successfully running this article in 72, these guys gave the global youth culture-driven countercultural environmental movement its soundtrack in a very powerful way, and did more in some sense to save the whales, I think, really, than just about the entire litany of scientists whose labors I laboriously recover across the 824 pages of this.
It's a fascinating read. Yeah. I really enjoyed it. We do want to hear from you as well and hear your questions. I think this might be a good time to open it up. And somebody will bring you a mic so that because we're recording for podcast.
Just recently in the news, they were talking about the scientists who are studying the plugs of earwax from whales and looking at the pesticide buildup in that tissue. What other areas are scientists looking at in terms of whales in the oceans?
So there'd be lots of different ways to answer. It's a great question. As it happens, the discovery of the layered and accumulative structure of that earplug was a major deal, 1955, Purvis and Fraser. And that article was significant. You might wonder, why would anyone care that most mysticetes have really nasty earwax? But in 1955, remember those mathematical models that I showed you where we were going to try to get control of the industry by doing basically surplus production models of what would be a sustainable yield for the population? To make these models work, you have to know the age profiles of the population. You have to know how old the animals are, right? Because it's about age classes. And it's very hard to age a whale. You can't ask them, right? They don't know. And so when somebody split one of these ear things down the middle, and it looked like tree rings inside, it was like, whoa, okay, hold on, this is the big moment. And there was a huge amount of work done then to calibrate the aging that could come off of those devices with the other aging techniques that had been used to that point. But that's not only kind of your question. Your question was about bioaccumulation of toxins. And in one sense, there's a kind of a touching history of science story. Like, right about the same time that my old school, like, whale scientist with hip boots on, who'd spent years cutting into whales and kind of thought that was being a whale scientist, right about the time that these guys are given their walking papers and this whole kind of whaling science is defunct, a few of them get together and they're like, well, actually, we should still do it a little bit, shouldn't we? Because, you know, now there's like nuclear weapons testing, there's all these like radioisotopes building up in the ocean, and what's a better bioaccumulator roaming the world's oceans and, you know, sucking up the food chain? We can actually probably use them as like ecological monitoring systems. We just have to have one whaling vessel that that we can use to go around the world and shoot them. And we'll just put all us guys before we retire on that boat, and we'll go out and still shoot them and cut them up, but we'll do it in order to like see if they function as monitoring devices pre-robotics for the world's toxins. So I'm not especially familiar with this most recent thing, but that gives you a little bit of a long durée, all the way back to the, you know, late 50s, early 60s, people were beginning to think that they might be used to monitor that kind of stuff.
And I would just add, I think, some other sort of hot topics in terms of research on dolphins and whales today is, you know, this is very exciting confirmation this year that dolphin mothers actually name their babies. So everybody has an individual name and an individual signature whistle, and that those are recognized by the whole group. And I'd say that that's a pretty big discovery. And then a very contentious issue is, can we continue to have marine mammals in captivity? And films like Blackfish are really bringing that to the fore. And you do see that I think that that's having an impact on this conversation, which is actually, in this case, further ahead in Europe, the idea of maybe, you know, human rights for other sentient animals is several generations ahead of us, but it's coming here. So those are screens to watch.
Yeah. Next question. Hi, I have a question. Excuse me. You mentioned 1974, the public consciousness really changed as far as whales. Was that due to legislation? I spent a year in 1973 working at the Nantucket Whaling Museum, and I got to tell you, we sold lightship baskets and scrimshaw by the ton back then. I don't know if it's still legal. I'm sorry. I also like to mention I was able to read portions of Melville's original manuscript that was in the library there at the time. So I was very lucky. I spent a year there studying them. But what changed in 74?
Okay. So, you know, when you pick years, you know, then you get called on them. I mean, I would actually probably say in some ways that, you know, more changes in 72 than 74. 72 is the UN Stockholm Conference on the Environment, and that, for reasons I could explain if we had more time, was really very significant internationally. By 74, that kind of impact of what has occurred legislatively for the call for a moratorium, meaning a cessation of commercial hunting, that is, you know, kind of vested in a number of specific national legislations. So you see the project gaining momentum by 74. 75 is the Mendocino Ridge episode. So, you know, you're talking about a crucial half decade. But you allude to, you know, buying whale products and, like, did law change? And the answer is yes, law very much did change. The most important way that it changed was actually 69 to 70, when the U.S. quite amazingly lists as endangered all the world's whale species, basically. All the large whales are listed in the Endangered Species Act. So there's another story to tell about the history of the Endangered Species Act, and specifically that listing, because the act is very interesting, but then the list is the crucial place that the work gets done, because you got a way to argue you can't mess with this stuff, but then you have to decide what you're not going to mess with. And in fact, this is just kind of the work in progress. Friends at the Smithsonian who know the book and kind of helped me get much of the source material for the later sections of it recently came upon one of these cursed boxes I was just talking about, which is the box of all the stuff that related to the behind-the-scenes work being done by the scientists at the Smithsonian to try to get Hickel, who was then Secretary of the Interior, to include all the major whale species on the endangered species list, which they were successful in doing, even though, to be perfectly frank with you, sperm whales were, like, by no, to my mind, defensible account, endangered in 1969-70, not to mention minke whales and a bunch of other stuff that was just not even remotely endangered. But so it was a real coup. And I'm not done with, I mean, I'm working with a graduate student, because, to be honest with you, I'm a little tired of writing about whales at this point. So I don't know if I'm going to write that article by myself, but I have this terrific graduate student who's at the start of what will be a shining career, and I believe that he is going to do a smashing job on that article, and we'll know more about how it is that the whales got listed and the impact of that. Just very quickly, the truth is, again, the impact of the Endangered Species Act is muted. muted until you get the Packwood amendments, because basically what we do in this kind of crazy way, and I'm not really a legal historian, but like what we do in this crazy way is we like internationalize American law in a way in this period by basically saying, okay, our law is you can't mess with marine mammals. And sure, you folks out there can do whatever you want, except any countries that aren't doing the things that kind of we think are a good idea or that are the international norms by the IWC, you actually can't get access to U.S. markets for sale of any of your trade products. So that gets people's attention, because if you're like, you know, selling a lot of Norwegian salmon or whatever in the United States, and like suddenly you've got a very large lobby, the salmon fishermen and the salmon canners and the salmon smokers and the salmon packers, who are all like, you know, what's this that we're not going to be able to, like, we're going to have 26 million tons of Norwegian salmon, and to whom are we going to sell it if we don't have access to the U.S. market? That doesn't happen until slightly later, and it has, like, I'm speaking very grossly here, so if we're actually going to podcast this, I would just like to flag that this is extremely demanding technical stuff that I'm doing very loosely, and I'm not even really competent to do deeply and technically. Suffice it to say that to a considerable extent, the United States internationalizes its own domestic legislation on these kinds of issues via this set of funky amendments that shift access to U.S. markets. No, you can't, it's illegal. Like, just having ambergris is basically illegal now. All of this stuff is in CITES. You have to have like special documentation to carry a whale tooth, you know, from here to Pasadena. You can't do anything.
I think Sarah's waiting up
Sorry.
There.
Sorry.
Getting back to Moby Dick a bit, I read the book, The Essex, and, you know, the part about the ramming of the boat, the real. Could you give your opinion based on what we know about whales now? What was the context, you know, from the whale's viewpoint? And if you know of more stories like that, has there been more study?
So some of you out there are thinking, this guy's not competent to answer that question. He's a 20th century whale historian. But no. You've not yet consulted my full opus and oeuvre. So a previous book was alluded to, which, I'm almost slightly embarrassed to acknowledge having written, but in 2007 I published a book called Trying Leviathan, which is in some sense a book about like kind of the scientific understanding of whales between 1700 and the beginning of the 20th century. It's not really about that, but that'll do for the purpose of answering this question. Yeah, the whale definitely rammed the Essex. I've never heard anybody argue that it like did it by accident. And, you know, the eyewitness accounts describe, I think quite persuasively, a sort of like hit it once, back up, get a bead line on it, hit it a second time, which, you know, suggests an animal. I mean, the world is large and crazy things happen. It's certainly possible it was just flailing around and disoriented, but I see no particular reason to think that that would have been the case. So by asking me to do the kind of whale's perspective, you stretch me. Right. I mean, there are some people who are very good at this kind of thing. Whitehead, Tyack, you know, there are people who spend big chunks of their life in like small sailboats behind pods of these animals trying to think their way into their lifeways. And I'm interested in how those people think about what they're doing, and that idea of a kind of almost like participatory ethnography of the animals. The Cold War scientists built little like whale-shaped pods that looked like the gun turrets of, you know, B-29 bombers, so that they could like go along under the water with the animals and sort of think their way into them. And Lily endlessly fantasized a dolphin suit so that he could get into the tank with them and swim with them, you know, while dropping acid and with headphones on that were playing stereo. So there's a lot of interest in like getting into that kind of perspective. And I guess what I would say is I do feel that stretches my like competencies. But I have no difficulty thinking that the animal had identified that there was a serious problem, that the serious problem was located there in that object, and that it, at that point, had decided that it was going to put some hurt on that thing. That seems...
And I would add, I mean, we don't know really as much about what a whale might be thinking, but we have some idea what an ape might be thinking, and you know, they have similarly large brains for body size, and now that we have some that are language trained, we really have, you know, some insight into their capacities for empathy and for Machiavellian thinking and for deception and, you know, some idea about their worldview to some extent. So I think those answers are coming, and I think it's a great question to ask, and a very humanist, humanist into the 21st century kind of question of not only how they are like us, but how we might be like them or be able to enter into their world. It's just kind of a cool question.
Thank you both for your presentation and your discussion. It's been great. Dr. Parrish, you mentioned a really interesting comparison between, you compared the story of the whale that we've been talking about tonight to the sort of ongoing story of climate change and how, mm-hmm. you know, perceptions of climate change are evolving slowly. And I was wondering, sort of a question for both of you, if there are other points in history where you might make similar comparisons or locate kind of similar, you know, entanglements of politics and science.
Mm. Well, a contemporary one that was really on my mind in reading this book was what we're at the moment calling fracademia, which is the hiring of academics by the fracking industry to produce science that basically says there's no problem with fracking. And there are some local universities that you could look up right here in LA that are involved in this controversy. And I think it's a little bit shameful. So that's a contemporary one. I don't know what comes to mind for you.
Yeah, my distinguished colleague and dear friend, Naomi Oreskes, did a wonderful book called Merchants of Doubt about the tobacco lobby. You know, some of you may know that book and the way that if you get serious and dig down, you can sort of follow the way it is that people are kind of bought by industries. You know, what interests me in particular is the complicated way that doubt or uncertainty functions in the political sphere and the scientific sphere slightly differently. And that can make for a kind of unholy cocktail. Because doubt is essential to the sort of promotional life of research agendas in science. If you want to get a grant, you have to say that there's something we don't know. And so the whole project of sort of successfully developing and nurturing and maintaining research programs hinges on the cultivation of judiciously located urgent doubt. And yet, doubt can also be redeployed, especially in the complicated sphere of democratic politics, to waylay and enmesh and mire political action. And, you know, you'll hear people talk about the precautionary principle. We shouldn't do anything unless we have adequate knowledge. Then that gets turned around and mobilized in ways people don't like. What I would say is, understanding the actual dynamics of these situations in specific cultural media climates ends up being, to my mind, more valuable than any of the kind of sweeping generalizations that one can offer about these kinds of dynamics. What I'm saying really is an argument for history over philosophy. We think philosophical generalizations on these matters end up being so much bloviation. You got to actually like get those boxes I've kept talking about and read the stuff that's in them and figure out like what actually happened in specific situations. And that forms an imperfect guide to what we're going to do next because, you know, the internet and the ways that information moved in that was uncontemplated in the era of Madison Avenue PR firms. So these are the challenges that we face as political actors, where we can inform ourselves on the basis of historical episodes, but we're always going to be moving kind of into the light in a way that's going to require, you know, creative, new, imaginative thinking.
In Moby Dick, Melville had mentioned there are actually only two whales that they were interested in. One was the sperm worm, the sperm whale mostly, and then the right whale, and that was just because of the oil. Once the oil wasn't a preference right now because of the oil being discovered in Pennsylvania and other places. Did the shift to what they were going after, what the whaling industry was going after, focus on a different whale?
Species. That's a great question. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I should have said this. It's a super basic and important question. Yes is the answer. Totally different set of species, primarily hunted in the 20th century. So the 19th and the 20th century whaling industries are distinguished by the technologies used for the hunt, cold steel, sail, oar, versus explosive ordnance and factory vessels under steam or diesel power, and by the species that were primarily pursued, 19th century, basically right and sperm, although also some bowhead and some gray. And then the 20th century industry is the rorqual whales, meaning the big whales with striations under their jaws, meaning blue, fin, and Say and Brutus whales, which are smaller versions of the same thing. Why were those species not hunted in the 19th century? Not because they don't have lots of oil. They have much more. Not because they don't have lots of oil. They have much more oil. Not because it's a different oil. No, it's broadly speaking the same oil. It's just it's fat. It's organic fat. Sperm whales have a slightly different product, but bracket them for a second. Why didn't they hunt the really big ones in the 19th century? They just couldn't. They're too big to catch with those technologies. You could probably poke one with one of those harpoons, but then you were just going to get dragged, you know, indefinitely because you weren't able to lance those animals enough times, because that's what you do. You poke it, right? You stuck to it, then you've got a line, you ride, Nantucket, sleigh ride kind of thing. You ride along behind. But what you do is you wait for the animal to surface, you pull up to it, and then you actually lance it, not with a harpoon, but just with a big, long knife. And you just do that for, like, you know, however long it takes, sometimes a day. It dives, you pull up next to it, you lance it when it comes to the surface, then it dives again, you wait, you ride, you ride, you ride, you wait for it to come to the surface, you pull up, you lance it again. But if you do that to, you're toast with a blue whale, you'll never get it done. And then anyway, even if you do get it done, here's the other amazing fact, their muscle to fat ratio is such that about 90% of the time, the rorqual whales, should you kill one of them, they sink. So, and at that point, you're not keeping it up by, like, attaching a couple of, like, you know, inflated sealskin bladders to it or something like that. So they didn't hunt them because they knew that if they did succeed in killing one, they weren't going to be able to keep it. How did they keep them afloat? This is another one of the crazy whaling stories. The entire modern whaling industry is contingent not just on, somebody's going to put a hook on me in a second here. I know. You see, she's coming. Look, there she is. She's got a hook. So they'll drag me off, giving you this last piece of, like, esoteric modern whaling information. They actually developed on-board air compressors with a hose that was attached to a long hypodermic poking needle that they would stick the dead animal with and blow it up with air, such that it rode high in the water like a big balloon until they could drag it to the ship. So,
well,
there you
I
go.
Hate to end on that there you note.
Know.
So,
there you know.
I think we should say that we should all feel very grateful that we actually did make progress in the 20th century to protecting our aquatic cousins. And I really appreciate you being here tonight and engaging in this dialogue. And thank you to all of you for being here. And thank you to the LA Library Foundation for making this possible.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.